Hello and welcome to the July Aldi podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Aldi magazine. This month's Aldi interview is with Barry Cryer, the comedy writer who's written for everyone from Bob Hope to Morecambe and Wise. He's also appeared on the BBC radio series I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue since its first episode in 1972. In the interview, Barry talks about his old friend Tony Hancock, the brilliant star of Hancock's Half Hour, who died 50 years ago this summer.
It was absolutely huge, Hancock's Half Hour, for people, the younger listeners and readers. It was enormous in the late 50s and early 60s. I think he was the first person to get £1,000 an hour on radio. So it was the combination of Galton Simpson and him. And that character, the sort of mournful character with social aspirations, is that him in real life as well?
Yes, I think it was. Yeah. Also, his occupation was never clearly defined. As the series went on and on, to start with, he was Tony Hancock, this comedian. But then he'd be something else sometimes. Galton Simpson played around with the format. And Ray and Alan told me, and they admired Kenneth Williams very much, but they said, Kenneth wasn't what we were doing anymore. He was sort of Mr. Catchphrase, good evening, and don't stop messing about, and getting big laughs. And Ray and Alan regretted it. They agreed to drop Kenneth Williams because it wasn't what they were doing anymore. They were doing character, and he was just playing funny man who comes to the door and all that, and stealing the whole show. And of course, Tony got a big thing about he's stealing it, this man. And he and Sid James got on pretty well, but Tony was quoted more than once as saying, I'm not in a double act with Sid. And, you know, it really hurt Sid because he was really fond of Tony, and he was dumped.
And hurt Kenneth as well, did it?
Kenny, I mean, his diaries, if you read, very abrasive and acid about almost everything he did. You know, come home and write about Round the Horn, oh dear, that rubbish. And,
yeah.
Oh, and Carry On films, that rubbish I'm doing. These people are just amazing, but the idea you get the conjunction of Kenneth Williams and Tony Hancock in the same show, there could be trouble there.
Yeah. I think you've described elsewhere that you thought Tony Hancock was bipolar. Do you think that's fair?
Yes.
Yeah.
Except, I think now you've made me stop and think, I think there's much more down than up.
Right.
He was solidly melancholy, Tony, except for that, which I referred to, that marvellous moment. He sat laughing and laughing at ballroom dancing. He found that very funny that they're in full evening dress and waltzing and everything. It was a joy to watch that moment. Hancock's laughing at something. He was a complete cliche, the broken-hearted clown. He was just... Yeah.
And his brother is or was your agent, is that right?
Roger Hancock was my agent, yes. And Tony's brother, yeah.
And did he bear any similarity or does he bear any similarity to him?
Oh, no, no. No, that's it, there's a sibling, yes. Oh, Roger Hancock, basically enormously jolly extrovert man, and did a very tough deal. Other agents used to talk about him, but they could never talk about him without smiling because he was a character. Everybody liked Roger Hancock. He was gregarious, you see, the exact opposite.
Still with us, is he, Roger?
No, Roger died years ago. Yeah. And I was in the office with Roger once, and he was talking to somebody about a job that had come up for me. And he said on the phone, your projected fee for Mr. Cryer is ridiculous. And then looked across at me and went, like, I'm playing the game here.
Brilliant.
Anyway, we're straying off to Roger, aren't we? But the two brothers, that is fascinating. They were so opposite. Everybody liked Roger Hancock. He lit up a room when he came in. Tony darkened the room when he came in.
And people have said that John Cleese in Fawlty Towers and Ricky Gervais in The Office are borrowing something from Hancock, that classic frustrated, socially aspiring man. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and I do good pompous. Our comedy, our great comedy is about people who are trapped. Tony Hancock was always trapped in a situation. The Steptoes are trapped. Basil Fawlty was trapped. Victor Meldrew was trapped. Rigsby was trapped. Everybody's trapped trying to get out and they've got aspirations. And You know they're not going to make it. And Hancock was a classic of that. He's never going to make it.
I think you've also said that brilliant, grueling Freeman face-to-face interview. There's a stage where Freeman asks him, you haven't made it very big abroad, and that really played on his mind. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes. There's a story, Harry, and I've never been able to check the details. He went to Hollywood. He went to Hollywood and got a bit part in a film, a support part. Now, I haven't checked this out, and was sacked from the film. Roger heard about it, and they put him on a plane and flew him home. Drunk, late, didn't know the lines, but he thought, oh boy, Hollywood, now I'm getting somewhere. Oh, very sad that. And as I said, The Wrong Box was his very last appearance in a film.
And you, as you've just said, were going to write with Eric Idle for him. Do you know what sort of thing you were going
to
write?
No, we never got round to even what we were going to do. He'd done, he was making solo appearances, a show from Blackpool on a Sunday night, and he did a short-lived series called Hancock's, set in a nightclub where he was the host introducing people. And it was all right, but he was on the fade, the great days had gone when you watched that. You thought, oh, well, yeah, this is okay. But, oh, it's an absolute cliche, his career. It's like, you know, John Osborne had written it or something, you know, The Entertainer or something. It's up, 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 and then down on the decline.
And then also, not too nice to the women, and famously had an affair with John Lemessurier's wife.
Oh, yes.
And John Lemessurier forgave him, is that right?
John Lemessurier made a career out of forgiveness. He didn't want confrontation, and he liked all the people involved and would just back off and say, yes, all right. And when Tony was, yes, that's right, John Lemessurier welcomed Tony in. He came to live with them, because Tony was having a bad time and everything. And how does Tony repay him? Go off with his wife.
Yes, that's pretty
nasty.
There's
a sort of primitive justice, I suppose. He treated other people really badly and he paid the price.
And do you think that whole generation, John Lemessurier, Kenneth Williams, Tony Hancock, Sid James, all roughly of an age, easy to call any time a golden age, but they were brilliant. Do you think it's something to do with the famous NSF-style wartime
thing? Yes. I think it's like the Goon Show. The Goon Show was our Monty Python, my generation. We would gather around the radio set listening to the Goon Show. These men had been in a war. They could have been killed. They'd had friends who were killed. So they came out of the war. Thank God I survived. No respect for authority. So the Goon Show was a complete watershed. It was to the BBC, to the government, to everybody. And yes, that generation, very hard. And then they'd come to London and they'd work at the windmill doing six shows a day. They really got their apprenticeship in. Harry Secombe was the first of the goons who worked at the windmill. He was almost subsidising the others. Harry was working.
Where you worked as well.
Yeah. I was after Harry, but there was a real hard training, and then they'd go on the road. I saw Peter Sellers at the Empire Theatre in Leeds, Michael Benty, and they all did an act, it was a heavy school. And of course Tony had been in Educating Archie and other radio shows and things before. He'd done his apprenticeship on radio before. But then again, you see, even in another radio show, he was playing a character. He wasn't playing ostensibly Tony Hancock, the comedian.
Right.
And that was where his strength was. And I think that's where his hang-up was, that I'm not that funny unless I've got a funny script.
Right. I think and that's trying and thus getting rid of everyone.
Yes. It wasn't an ego thing in a way. Well, I suppose it was. It was a self thing about I've got to get rid of everything else and see if I exist in the middle of all this. Am I any good just on my own? You know, and then you do a film like The Punch and Judy Man and that really exposed it. And you think, well, yeah. Where's Galton and Simpson?
So the terrible conclusion is that Kenneth Williams is right, that he was, as you've just said, a brilliant comic actor.
Yeah.
Tony Hancock, but he was no writer.
No, and he wouldn't spot a bad script if he saw it. He sort of knew instinctively the Galton and Simpson scripts were good, but subsequently he couldn't, or he wasn't getting, he hadn't a choice anymore, he wasn't being offered really good scripts. I'm being rude to writers who I won't name because I can't remember most who wrote for him subsequently, but oh no, it was nowhere up to the Galton and Simpson standard, the stuff he was doing later. And it showed.
And perhaps a certain element of ego that by the time he gets rid of Sid James, and I think 1960 or 1961, Kenneth Williams, Galton Simpson soon afterwards, he has been enormous for almost 5-10 years. So yes. Had that gone to his head as well? I mean, he was incredibly famous.
Oh, yes. That's true. There was an ego. I'm really... And could I make it in America? And
yeah.
Why am I just settling for being a star here? I can make it over there, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would... I retract what I said. I suppose there must have been a real ego thing as well. Ego combined with insecurity, yeah. Which is not
they
a good
go
combination.
Together. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that, the cliche of the melancholy clown, which you must be bored with being told about, because you're certainly not melancholy, are you, Barry? But it's a luck of the draw, isn't it?
I'm not a comedian.
Well, you tell pretty good jokes.
Well, thank you. Yeah. But I tell stories and sing songs, but I'm not original. And all the brilliant people I work with were original. You couldn't analyse. I used to call it the X Factor, obviously don't call it that now. Funny bones. The comedians I worked with, the men and women, they were really good. They were original. There was nobody quite like them. I like the word entertainer. I'm quite happy with that, or raconteur, but I'm not a comedian. I tell stories and sing songs.
And you think those comic geniuses need something, an odd streak.
Yes, there's a strange factor in there that you can't, and I don't want to analyse it. The great quote about comedy, I can't remember who said it was, analysing comedy is like dissecting a frog. Nobody laughs and the frog dies.
Very good, very good.
You don't analyse. If somebody doesn't laugh at a joke, there's no way you can then explain to them why they should have laughed because it was funny. No. Game over. It's a rough, naked game. Ours, I think, the comedy game. If you sing a song or you're in a play or you're in a band, you could discuss with somebody afterwards why you liked it and they didn't. You could have a really good, interesting discussion. Somebody says, he, she, not funny. It's very personal. They don't like somebody because you didn't make them laugh.
Right.
Ted Ray, the great Ted Ray, said, you go... one night to see, you meet 300 strangers and it's not going well. And he said, I wanted to stop in the middle of my act and say, I've been married for over 30 years, I pay all my income tax, I'm quite a nice man.
You can analyse why shows do well. Can you, for example, can you analyse why I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue is so fantastic and has survived so long? I mean, it's almost 50 years now, isn't it?
But we don't know. Finally, we're very happy about it. We're not complacent. I don't know what it is. It hasn't got a script. It's got a running order, and we get advance notice of topics and songs and things. But we don't know what each other's going to do. So if you hear us laughing, it's genuine.
Yeah, yeah.
I always say it's probably at its best when it starts falling apart. That silliness... The great Humphrey Littleton said, never lose touch with silly.
And on that front, on the panel game front, I don't know if you saw that stuff about Have I Got News For You, about men being much better at sort of abusive humour. Did you see that story? That not enough women get
in. Oh, no, Ian Hislop and Paul Merton.
Yeah, exactly.
And Ian was a bit, he was sort of patronising, but he was saying, you know, patting them on the head a bit. Women are too modest and realistic. They don't... You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Oh. Don't agree with that. That sort of... actually, it's not... It's jokily abusive on the clue, isn't it?
Yes, it's patronisingly, sort of.
Yeah.
Joe Brand and Victoria Wood, God rest her, they both fought off John Naismith because they'd both done Just a Minute or something and not enjoyed it. And Joe Brand told me, She said, oh, those old men, you know, who wants to know about that? But finally she said yes and enjoyed it.
Right.
Victoria Wood enjoyed it when she did it.
Right.
Because we've always wanted women, our producers always wanted women to do it, and he's been fought off through the years often, but not that one, you know.
Yeah, well, I thought
and now we get Sue Kelman and Pippa Evans, and people do it now, and Sally Toksvig did it.
Oh, yeah.
She did the stage tour when Jack D couldn't do it. Brilliant.
But very hard to do it from scratch, actually, I'd have thought.
Well, we find it with Miles Jopp.
Yeah.
Did it for the first time, and I could tell it. Brilliant, Miles. But I think Miles said it to me. He said, you're very nervous the first time you do Clue. He said, because, oh, this lot have been doing it for years. You feel really like the new boy or whatever.
And, yeah.
And then we try and relax them, you know, and we play to them when they're on there. Kenny Everett did it and did no preparation whatsoever. So they said, Baz, look after him. And of course, on the night, he stole the whole bloody thing.
He had that streak of genius.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Oh, Everett was. Well, he was the only non-comedian I ever worked with. He was Kenny Everett.
What do you mean? He wasn't putting on any...
He wasn't a comedian as such. He was just the mad radio DJ or something. You couldn't analyse him. But you gave him an idea and he just went off and running with it.
Well, that's a very good point to stop, Barry. And thank you so much to Barry Cryer for the Oldie podcast and for his terrific article in the July issue of the Oldie magazine.